Okay. Do we have questions? You guys read the, apart from understanding whatever happened last time, you also read the GPCSP paper as well as the multiple encodings of planning as satisfiability. I am going to look at them in today's class. I mean, in particular, GPCSP we already sort of mentioned last time, but the connection to planning as satisfiability may or may not be clear. I'm going to make that today. Before I start, if there are some pressing questions, please bring it up. And then, you know, if I anyway going to deal with them, I'll just postpone them. Okay. So anything about last class that there were any questions on? Okay. So we were looking at the idea of doing graph plans, planning graph search, you know, by converting it into various combinatorial substrates. We looked at SAT already last time. And I mentioned that one of the advantages of converting into SAT is that you can then use existing SAT solvers, so you don't have to solve the problem yourself. I mean, in the sense, you don't have to write the backward search algorithm. Okay. One thing that that you should understand is that converting a planning graph into SAT and solving it it looks as if on the top of it actually is redundant, because first you would say k-length planning graph, convert it into a SAT encoding, look to see if there is a solution for it. If it doesn't, then what you do, you actually extend the planning graph and reconvert it back into a brand new encoding. Okay, normally that's how it works. Okay, so in fact, if you have black box running in front of you, which basically does exactly this, it does graph plan and then conversion to SAT, you would see between iterations, you know, it would say calling SAT solver and then waits for a while, and then, you know, no solution, and then extending the planning graph and then reconverting it into SAT. Now, one interesting thing is that in the graph plan's original planning graph algorithm that we saw, you could actually reuse some of the work that you did in the previous levels when you go to the next level. How do you do that? What was it that we talked about that allows graph plans, planning graph search, backward search algorithm to reuse some of the work it did in the previous levels in the next level? What? Memos. And memoization, and in particular, and also, first of all, it doesn't have at all this whole issue of reconverting anything. It's the graph exists already. Furthermore, even the search information, if you have certain failures that you have encountered previously, you can remember them so that you don't have to, you know, prove to yourself that it won't work again. Now, SAT plan, I mean, the SAT conversion essentially is losing that. Maddening is that even though it loses that, SAT solver solves the problem faster than planning graph directly searching, the backward search on the planning graph. Do you understand what I'm saying? So now, does anybody remember what could be, if somebody asks you, why could it be that anything that SAT conversion is doing, presumably you should be able to do in your own normal algorithm too, right? Laziness aside, you should be able to do something that the SAT is doing in the original algorithm. So exactly which aspect of the original graph plan's backward search would you say is sort of holding it back in terms of, you know, not being able to solve the problem as fast? Exactly, the backward part of it. There is no reason to think, even though it's easier to understand, there is no reason to think that you should start looking for the search, you know, solution this way. Okay, and in fact, we will see before we are done, part of what I would like to do in today's class, and by the end of today's class, we'll be done with, you know, bounded length planning, but it would be a wild swing. Okay, so you could never tell whether I am rooting for planning graph, direct planning graph search, or converting it into encodings. or whether you even care about planning graph and just go directly and do encodings. But hopefully, you know, when you're all done with it, remember that beginning picture that I'll show you in the end, and which is this, all these ideas connected with potential trade-offs that you want to understand, okay? So, in fact, we will talk about a search directly on the planning graph that is significantly faster than anything any encoding can do. But there is an advantage for converting it into encodings because you get to be lazy. You don't have to, you know, generate a new algorithm. Okay, but we'll see some other kinds of advantages too. In particular, suppose I were to have converted, suppose I have converted this planning graph into this kind of an encoding. Okay, suppose now my friend comes running and says, you know, I have the following piece of information. I know for sure that if ever, you know, at A is true in the zeroth level and at B is true in the proposition level 1, then it cannot be the case that at RS is true in the final level. He wants to tell me this. This is extra piece of information they want to tell me. Okay. Now, if it was planning graph, if it's a direct search in the planning graph, if people want to give you information, you don't quite know how to use it. Here, that's just a nice little SAT formula, just like this. So whatever extra information you know about the, you know, problem, especially if it can be expressed in terms of, you know, propositions that and actions that are true at different levels, you can just throw that in. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, my friend can come and tell me, look, you know, I understand that you're going to solve this, but I have some specific requirements on the kind of solutions you're going to produce. Not all solutions are equally good for me. I want certain solutions. For example, I really, really want there to be a specific action should not be present in the first level. Can you get me a plan where that specific action is not present? Yeah, I can do that. I'll just throw not of that action to that level. So there is this advantage. You know, once you convert it into, this is the same thing for assembly language, right? If you write a C program, convert it into assembly language, then you can link every other assembly language program to it. Okay, so that's the advantage that you do have here in terms of any time when you convert into, you know, a particular encoding. Okay, I did mention what was the deal about SAT solvers and optimality. Can SAT solvers working on this particular kind of representation produce optimal plans or not? I'm just testing to see whether or not people are, you know, getting anything. So can I get an optimal sequential plan by converting the planning graph into SAT encoding and solving it fast? You remember that I will find the solution at, if I can't find the solution at the kth level, then only I'll go to the k plus 1th level. So it looks as if I'm going to get optimal k level plan, right? I mean, the first, I would get the shortest plan before I go any far, you know, I won't go far longer plans unless I'm forced to. So the question is, why won't that give me optimal plans? What? It's only level optimal. You know, again, I'm just checking whether or not things are going through. It's only step optimal. And to make steps equal to number of actions, you must say that each action, I mean, there is only one action per level. That increases the number of mutexes that you throw in, and because of which the SAT plan will have to go much longer, much farther. Okay. Now, there is one other thing, as long as I have it in front of me, once I, you know, there is really no reason why, you know, if in fact you know for sure that the length of the solution in terms of number of levels has nothing to do with optimality. Okay, then is there any pressing reason as to why you should start with zero size planning graph, one size, two size, etc., up to n size? If all I want is a plan, okay, must I show to myself that there is no 10 level plan before showing to myself that there is an 11 level plan? If I get a badge for getting a 10, you know, 11 optimal level plan, maybe I want to do it. there are no badges for optimal level plans, right? And if you're anyway just, you know, getting a badge for getting a plan, then I would say, why not just search up to 20th level? Even if you think that the plan for this problem is probably somewhere between 10 and 20, let's say. Why not just grow the planning graph all the way to 20, convert it into SAT, search. What's the advantage of that? The advantage of that is, if you think 20 is the upper bound for the length of the plan in terms of number of levels, this SAT solution will this SAT encoding will definitely have a solution. This SAT encoding will definitely have a solution. Okay? Yeah, of course, it could be non-minimal. That means it might have actions which are not actually required. You know, you could have removed some actions. But surprisingly enough, even if in fact you were to produce a level minimal plan, even if you produce a level minimal plan in SAT plan, that can be non-minimal. In fact, it's very well known that if you run SAT plan, if you run this kind of, there's this algorithm called black box, which is converting planning graph into SAT, okay? It gives out sometimes wildly, ridiculously non-optimal plans. It's not just, it's true that it's minimal in terms of levels, but in terms of number of actions, it's not even close. It has actions that are like unnecessarily there, which are not doing anything. Now, that's actually an interesting point. Planning graph, whatever you might say about planning graph, if you do backward search on the planning graph, you don't get easily non-minimal solutions. Okay, everybody is supporting somebody. So what did we do in this such that when I get a solution that can actually be non-minimal? It turns out that while you were sleeping, when I went through these, you know, conversion, you know, one of the things that you have to keep in mind is anytime you convert a problem into a combinatorial substrate, if you are serious, you need to do an if and only if proof. What is that if and only if proof? If there is a solution for the original problem, there is a solution for the combinatorial problem. And vice versa. For every solution here, there is a solution exactly there. That's what you need to do. Did we do that? Of course not. You know, I mean, I just said, yeah, look, you know, it's a reasonable number of, you know, encodings, and you're happy. Okay. But the interesting thing is that I said, if there are actions, there are preconditions. Okay, if you look at the actions, if I have an action here, then one of all these preconditions must be satisfied. And we said, if there is a precondition, some action must be supporting it. But I didn't say that if there is an action, it better be supporting some effect in the next level. Did I say it? No. Okay, in the backward search of planning graph, I make sure that I don't bring in an action unless it is supporting somebody. SAT guys, essentially, they are looking for a model that satisfies all your constraints. So it is very easy for you to, you know, toggle some actions which aren't doing anything useful in the next level. That's really bad non-minimality. That means there are actions that aren't doing anything. And you get them dime a dozen.
Yeah, but the SAT algorithms are really good for that kind of SAT stuff, like SAT instances.
Mm-hmm.
No,
no. The point is that then after you get the SAT solution, you have to remove these non-minimal actions. Okay, either that, or alternately, you have to write, apart from these constraints, extra constraints, saying that if there is an action at this level, if an action at this level is true, then it is in fact helping some guy in the next level. That's the constraint I didn't write. Normally, when you're writing encodings, you try to avoid writing too many constraints, because as you write more and more constraints, the size of the encoding increases. Okay? And so the quick and dirty thing we did was we removed that constraint. And so we can get non-minimal plans, but they are still minimal in terms of number of levels, it turns out. Right? I can have two-level plan where each level there are like 2,000 extra actions doing nothing, hanging around. Okay? So anyway, so the reason I actually brought this up is that checking whether or not you put exactly the right set of constraints is not all that easy, you know. So in this case, actually, and in fact, unfortunately, in this, in the rest of the talk, you know, in the rest of today's class, as well as most of the work on converting planning into some computational substrate, it's always, look, here is my encoding. Can't you understand it is correct? As against, here are the 10,000 pages of proof saying if and only if holds. Okay, this is not just for planning. In fact, you know, you'll see that there's this whole cottage industry of people trying to convert their problems into integer programming problems, or their problems into SAT problems. And some of them try to show that the encoding is if and only if. It's tight. And some just basically make a nice hand-wavy argument. Okay, so as far as you are making these encodings, keep that in mind, that, you know, sometimes you may not have put all the constraints that are required. And if you could actually be missing constraints that can leave unsound plans to come out, that would be really bad. In this case, it was only non-minimal. It's not unsound. It wasn't unsound because if somebody is here, their preconditions will be satisfied in the previous level. The only question we didn't ask is, what the heck are you doing here? Are you supporting somebody? No, we didn't ask that. To ask that, you have to write a whole bunch of extra constraints. Okay. Yes, sir. Yeah.
From it with the speed of it would add the constraint of the action method, and so the F must be true. So we are using the relevance from the goal. And if we are just using the
No, but you do have some of the relevance constraints. You did say for every goal here there should be at least one action.
But not all, right?
No. See, in terms of reachability and relevance, you did capture those. The question, of course, is, are there going to be any actions that are redundant? And you did not capture that in these constraints. And this is, by the way, state of the art. In fact, if you look at the, you know, if you read the paper, in fact, these are the way the constraints are written. And funnily enough, you know, people who would then try to use black box to solve planning problems and want optimal plans would be realizing, it's like so many extra actions which are not doing anything. And so you get to write an extra paper. Writing a paper called, you know, minimizing SAT, you know, plans generated by black box. There is a paper by Bart Selman and his student, Selman being one of the co-authors of this paper, showing how to minimize. And it turns out that given a plan, truly minimizing it is NP-hard. But the kind of silly non-minimal actions that SAT plan puts, oftentimes you can capture those because these are guys who are not doing anything. They're just hanging around, doing nothing. And they can be plucked off easily enough. Okay? Anyway, so that's worth keeping in mind. Then, what else? Because this is basically what I'm saying. What I just said here is written there. That, you know, we are not stopping an action from becoming true when it is not doing anything useful in the next level. If you want to stop it, the only way you can do that is to write a constraint. Because once you write the constraint, then the solver doesn't ask you, you know, I mean, all it checks is whether or not a model is consistent with all the constraints. Now, in terms of compilation to CSP, I pointed out last class that one advantage of compilation to CSP, it turns out, is, of course, CSP can be thought of as multi-valued SAT. A SAT can be thought of as Boolean-valued CSP. But beyond that, there are other interesting procedural differences. It turns out that CSP solvers are normally written with the understanding that each constraint is a procedure, which takes a partial assignment and says yes or no. Yes, I'm happy with this. No, I'm not happy with it. Okay, so since the solvers are written that way, it turns out that sometimes, you know, rather than write a huge number of declarative constraints, okay, you can write a little piece of code which just, you know, looks at the partial assignment, says yes or no. And this winds up being important. As I showed last time, you know, the memory consumption can be quite different whether you convert into CSP or SAT. Now, one thing in terms of converting into CSP, it's worth noticing here is, so in terms of CSP, there are variables and values, right? In SAT also, there are variables and values. So what are the variables and values in this? You can, one encoding that we that you read in the GPCSP paper, which is also here, is essentially saying the variables are the propositions, and their values are the different actions that can support them. That looks like a reasonable idea. Okay. The only problem, of course, is that in a normal CSP, you have a finite number of variables, a finite number of domains. I mean, each of them, there is a finite domain, and there are constraints on them already present. Okay. Now, if you think in terms of what happens in the planning graph, really, in the top level, you only need certain goals to be supported. So it's not that every proposition is a variable which requires a value. It's only some propositions require a value, right? And then once they need a value, their domains are well defined. And then you don't even know what you need here. It depends on what you select here. So this brings up the question as to what are the variables and what are the values? Do we know them upfront? The easiest way to think of it is this notion of dynamic constraint satisfaction, where essentially you start with only the variables that correspond to the goals, and you know their domains, and you know their preconditions, I mean the mutual exclusion constraint between them. And when you satisfy, when you give a variable a value, then it suddenly activates certain other variables in the previous level. Okay, that's exactly what is happening in GraphPlan, right? That's exactly what is happening in GraphPlan. So you could actually do this in terms of, I have a new, you know, the normal CSP is, I have a set of variables V, and they also have domains. Each of those variables have domains. In this view of dynamic constraint satisfaction, you essentially say, I really have a much bigger set, V hat of variables, of which V of the variables are currently active. And I only need to give values to the active variables such that no constraints are violated. The problem, of course, is when I try to give a variable a value, it not only gives that variable that value, it activates certain other variables. So basically, dynamic constraint satisfaction normally has these things called activation constraints. And activation constraints exactly sort of correspond to your subgoaling behavior. So it's like the number of the variables is increasing as you give values to certain variables. Okay. Now the problem, of course, is that's not a normal CSP problem. So if you have a CSP solver, it won't be dealing with activation constraints. How do you handle it? It turns out dynamic CSPs are just a little syntactic sugar on normal CSPs. Okay. All you need to do is for every variable, so what I need to know is whether or not a variable is active. If it is active, it requires a real action to support it. If it's not active, it doesn't require a real action to support it. Real action. So I make something called a dummy, null value. Every variable, you now add to that every variable a null value into its domain. Okay. Now it turns out that null, all variables can take null values, and there are no constraints about taking null values. Except when you start off the problem, you say a certain variables cannot have null values. Those are the ones that require real actions to support. And then everything just cascades out. You see what I'm saying? So all you need is just this little syntactic thing. So I couldn't write null value, so I wrote hash here. Okay, every variable has a null value basically added to its domain, and left to themselves, they'll just take that because those are the least constraining values. You know, you can take null value, and then other people can take other values, and you won't have any problem with them. Okay, so if I had nothing, no constraints about goals, the solution would be everybody takes null value and they're all happy. Okay, but then you start the problem off by saying certain variables cannot take null values. So that's just a constraint too. So V1 not equal to null is a constraint. Okay, so that's all I wrote here. So then it becomes a normal CSP. It's just a normal CSP where there is a special value called null value that you just added, and it just acts like normal CSP value. Okay, so those of you who know CSPs, how CSPs work, it's just a CSP problem. And the advantage of it now is once you give it to the CSP solver, there is no reason for it to go from this way to this way. It's just null is one of the possible values, and you know, a CSP solver can decide to give values to a variable down the stream, middle of the stream, top of the stream, it doesn't matter. Okay? So that's basically what was being discussed in the GPCSP paper. Okay? So for example, a subgoal, I mean the top level subgoals, they, you know, you say that they cannot have null values, and to say preconditions, if there is this action is true, its preconditions become true. Must be true, right? So in the CSP, I say, if this action becomes a value of a variable, then all its preconditions cannot have null values. That's what. Not having null values is being activated. That's all. And then CSP takes care of your problems after that. Okay? Then, of course, mutual exclusions can be written directly in terms of value constraints. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, so I was talking about this last class and I didn't have the slide, correct slide in front of me, but essentially if you were to hitch your wagon to CSP versus SAT versus the next thing which I'll show you, IP solver, let me actually show you the IP solver. Compilation to integer programming, again, I can't teach you integer programming already. I mean, I at least know that if you have done intro to AI, you know CSP and SAT already. And if you don't quite know integer programming and linear programming, you are not going to get it from just this one little description. But generally, the idea in, you know, integer linear programming is that you have a bunch of variables. They are real valued variables. And you have constraints on them, which are inequalities. They're all linear inequalities, okay? And if it is a linear program, then the, and so the objective function, there is also normally in integer linear programming, there's also an objective that you're trying to optimize, okay? If all you care about is any set of values that wind up not violating constraints, then you just make objective to be a constant so that all you care about is a feasible solution. Okay, one advantage actually of integer programming formulation is in fact this objective which considers an optimality metric. And it will look for a solution that has the best such optimality metric. If you're coming here from the classical planning side, you take the one thing that integer programming is good for, which is this objective function, and make it constant. Because you don't care about, you know, object, you know, optimization. But if you care about the number of actions to be minimized, you can write the objective in terms of the number of actions. Okay. Now, of course, in terms of the constraints, what are the kinds of constraints that you can write in, you know, SAT and CSP are very close. The only difference between them is SAT tends to assume declarative constraints. CSP can deal with procedural constraints. Just out of the box. Okay. But between IP on one hand and SAT CSP on the other hand, they are much more interesting differences. Okay. In particular, from the point of view of complexity class, integer programming is in the same exact complexity class as SAT and CSP. Okay. So that means a problem which can be solved by one substrate can be converted into the other substrate. But there are certain things that SAT can do, that IP can do better, and certain other things that SAT can do better. Certain constraints which can be written easily in one language compared to another language. Okay, a classic case of a constraint that can be easily written in IP, one case, for example, from our point of view, is this multiple mutual exclusion. Okay, let me see. This is not pairwise mutex. So if what I want to say is only one of X and Y and Z can be true. So they're all pairwise mutex. Okay? Normally you would have to write in SAT, you would have to write for every subset that either this is false or the other one is false. Here you get to write one single inequality, X plus Y plus Z less than or equal to 1. Okay. Now here, by the way, I'm assuming that the normal IP and LP allow, you know, real valued variables. If all you want is to convert a SAT and CSP problem into IP, then you just use 0, 1, or basically discrete valued variables. Okay? Now exactly that's that integrality. So, you know that those of you who have thought about this before, I heard about this before, you know that what makes linear programming easy and integer programming hard is that integer programming requires that the solution must have integral values to all the variables. Whereas linear programming says essentially any value in the interval.
Yeah, that's not NP.
What?
That's not NP.
Which one is not NP? Yeah. So the point is, it's the integrality requirement that actually makes it hard. And you do need that integrality requirement when you convert SAT problems into ILP. Okay? And that we do need it here. But there is one very nice thing. It is actually sort of a deeper problem, and I don't know how much you can appreciate it. Hopefully you will do once when we come back to true uses of ILP encodings, is that the way ILP problems are solved, the way IP problems are solved normally, is you set up an encoding, you write your objective function. Okay. Now, one of the advantages, as I said, is that in fact you get to write an objective function that is expressible as a linear function of any of these variables. That's an advantage. So I can talk about the shortest plan. I can also talk about the cheapest plan. Right? I mean, all I need to do to find the cheapest plan essentially is, you know the values, the cost of each of the actions. So you write your objective function such that it minimizes the sum of costs. Okay. Of course, there is this one issue that I'm still talking about taking an K-sized planning graph and converting it into integer programming. So that means in the K level, all I can get is a K level plan, a plan which is expressible in K level. If there is no such plan, then you have to extend it again. But within those K levels, I can ask for the cheapest plan just by changing the objective function. That's an advantage. You know, in the SAT case, you need to do a branch and bound search explicitly. Okay. Now, one very nice thing about the way ILP solvers normally work is the usual way they do is they take the IP encoding and they take the objective 2 and they do a linear programming relaxation. So they say, to heck with the integrality constraint. Okay, let's just solve the linear program. And so the linear program normally has fractional values for the variables. If it does not, if in fact the linear program gives integral values for the variables, you're done, because that's an optimal for the underlying IP. Okay, so the linear program gives fractional values. That essentially is a kind of relaxation. Remember, we were talking about relaxing plans by ignoring positive interactions, etc. Here you have linear programming relaxation of integer programs is a global relaxation which just ignores the integrality requirement. Okay, and so if in fact there is a way of executing half of an action, half of this action, 3/4 of that other action, this would indeed be an optimal plan. Okay, so it turns out that although we won't talk about it here, when you get interested in cost-oriented planning, which you will start getting interested in next class, you know, partial satisfaction planning, you could convert a problem into IP encoding, take its linear programming relaxation, and use that as a heuristic to push the planner. Do you understand what I'm saying? So again, I say this because we have done this, and you know, there are other people who have done this. So one of the advantages of knowing, I mean, so when you're looking at the different encodings, you want to know what are they good for, okay? And one good thing about integer programming encodings is that they actually can do optimization, and they also can very easily handle numeric quantities if you have numeric quantities lying about. Classical planning is in some sense the worst possible example for integer programming. Why? Because you don't care about optimality and you only have discrete variables. But if you start caring about optimality, and if you start having numeric variables, you would be happy that you remember, you know, that you learned about this here, because then extending it to handle those is no, I mean, extending, there is no extension involved at all in handling optimality. And to handle numeric variables, you will also have some constraints on those variables too. Okay? As of now, for classical planning, the state of the art is integer program-based encodings don't normally compete well with SAT and CSP encodings. And it should not be surprising to you, because the one thing that they are good at, you're not using. Okay? Now, the other thing, of course, is also related to this this slide that I mentioned earlier, last time. In terms of the solver development, okay, there is this issue of what can you write, what substrate allows you to write your problem in the most natural way. And there is also this issue of which substrate seems to be having better and better solvers. Okay, and in terms of the relative laid-backness of SAT, CSP, and IP solver communities, it's basically this is most laid back, this is somewhat more laid back, and this is least laid back currently as we speak. Okay, so SAT solvers, there is a SAT competition, there are people, you know, coming up with new solvers. So a normal rule of thumb is, if you generated some results with SAT solvers like last, you know, 2 months back, you may have to redo them. Quickly submit them before they become obsolete, because somebody else may, the state of the art SAT solver might be faster already. Okay, it's great, you know, it's good to be in a time of change, but it's also bad to be in a time of change. So, you know, SAT solvers, the solvers have been increasing even now, you know, in efficiency. IP solvers are on the other extreme. There isn't much of a community for improving IP solving, as far as I can tell, in terms of, you know, production quality IP solvers. Okay, there's only companies which generate these solvers. Like, for example, iLog is a company which generates Cplex, and you pay, you know, if you're a student, you pay $1,000. You know, if you are a university, you know, maybe $2,000, and if you're a company, maybe a gazillion thousand, and you get it, and then you solve your problems. Okay, and so if the solver improves, when they improve it, that's it. That's more or less the reality of this thing. So, in terms of the solver speed, if that's what is important for you, this is not necessarily the best place. But as I said, there are good things for this, which is IP allows objective functions, and it allows certain kinds of constraints to be expressed more effectively. There is also another thing, $1 million question that you always have in when you convert, and it becomes, you know, more so as we go on today's class, is when you convert a problem into a combinatorial substrate, normally there's not just a single way of converting it. Okay, in fact, we already saw that for the SAT one, this is one way, and adding that additional constraint, that's another way. Okay, but it's actually worse than that. You already artificially reduce the possibilities by saying not that how do I solve bounded length planning as a SAT problem, but by saying how do I look for a solution in a planning graph as a SAT problem. One of the things that I'll do in like next 10 minutes or so is, why care about planning graph? And if you don't care about planning graph, then there are multiple ways you can set up these encodings. And the question then becomes, how do you compare encodings? How do you say if there are three different encodings for a problem, which is better? Okay, and the subcommunity that actually has spent time thinking about it more carefully is the IP community, IPLP community. Okay, there's beautiful theory about it. So for example, one of the issue is you would consider if there are two encodings for solving the same exact problem, okay, you would say one is stronger than the other if its LP relaxation value here is bigger than the LP relaxation value here. So whichever is closer, so actually, no, that's not the way to put it. So it turns out that what you wind up doing, if you have, let's say, a two-dimensional IP, x here and y here, right? Now, all the integral solutions correspond to the grid points. all the potential integral solutions corresponding to the grid points. All you need to check is go to each of them and see whether they satisfy all the constraints, and if so, what is the value of the objective function there, and pick the one which has the highest value. That's all you need to do. Okay. Now, if you allow the constraints, of course, are linear constraints, right? So the constraints are essentially correspond to half planes. Okay. There is one constraint, there is another constraint, there is another constraint. So let's assume that the feasible region for all these constraints is inside. So then what you're doing essentially is every point in this region is a feasible, is a potential solution for the linear program. And you're trying to find which is the point that has the highest objective value. And you know, if you have not heard of IP, LP-LAC, linear programs before, one beautiful thing is the optimum has to be at one of the corner points. Even though there are infinite number of points inside this polytope, the optimum has to be at one of the corner points. And the way the LP solutions work is to go from one corner to other corner, in a directed way such that you get to the corner which has the highest value for objective function faster. Okay, and in fact, from the point of view of an encoding, suppose it turns out, so in this particular case, if I were to say that, notice that if I have a new encoding which has a constraint which is more like that, then at least this part of the space has been cut out from the polytope. And that couldn't have been a solution anyway. Okay, so the closer you can make these constraints come to their integer values of the integer valued grid, okay, the stronger the encoding is. The reason I bring this all up is people have at least thought about what makes an encoding stronger versus weaker. All you can do in SAT and CSP communities is, if you count the number of variables and number of variables and number of classes, and you say if there are more variables and more classes, the encoding is kind of hard to solve, which is totally bogus. Okay, it's sort of true in the sense if you have 3 variables and 15 classes versus 3 million variables and 15 billion classes, maybe, yeah. But you know, it's not normally true, because sometimes, in fact, one of the advantages is when you increase constraints, you can start with a set of constraints and do propagation on those constraints to derive more constraints. And that's normally supposed to be good, because constraint propagation is supposed to make things better. And yet, the idea of looking just at the number of variables and number of classes makes you think that once the number of constraints increase, that's bad. Okay. Furthermore, suppose you have like a SAT encoding, right, and you're about to solve the problem, and your friend comes and says, oh, by the way, I know the solution, right, and I want to give you this axiom which says A0 must be 1, A2 must be, A0 must be 1, B1, B2 must be 1, C3 must be 1. Those are the actions at the different level. These are the ones that are supposed to be set to 1, okay? So it's a conjunctive constraint, so it becomes 4 different constraints. You say, sorry, that will increase my complexity. I'm not going to take your extra knowledge. The reason I'm saying this is, it's the same issue when people start giving extra knowledge to the SAT solver. How do you make sense of when is it good to take extra knowledge? If you think that increasing constraints and variables is going to worsen the performance, then you would say, I don't want any more knowledge. Whatever I have is good enough. But that's bogus. Okay. I bring this whole thing up because you read the encodings paper in KR, and they compared multiple encodings in terms of exactly number of variables and number of classes. That's because that's the only thing that they know how to compare. Okay. But there are better ways of comparing encodings, obviously, and in the integer programming community, obviously, they have thought more about the sorts of strong versus weaker encoding. Okay, so that's one reason to keep these guys in business. Okay, I said the black box is this thing which does convert planning graph into SAT and GP CSP convert into CSP, and I looked at the relative performance last time. And then this is the relative trade-offs offered by the various compilation substrates. CSP allows more compact encodings. ILP allows more numeric constraints as well as optimization metrics. SAT may be, SAT has much faster solvers. And if you are one of those people who think in propositional logic, right, then, it's a more natural way to add knowledge. This is an interesting thing. So, in fact, for people who believe that IP is a more natural way to think, basically they think, these kinds of inequalities are easier to think of, okay? Whereas if you think these are more natural ways to think, then you think that the propositional logic is more natural for you. So that's a subjective issue as to, what is, when you say natural, to who is a question, okay? Okay. Any questions on this, all this stuff? Okay, now, so I went to planning graph, I solved it backward search-wise, and then I said, hey, you can convert it into SAT encodings and all these encodings, and then we looked at the relative advantages of converting into different kinds of encodings, okay? Now the question, of course, is what did we learn in terms of the big picture for that piece? Okay, so if you solve directly, then the good things are that you can do all sorts of approaches for compactly representing the plan. So for example, the bi-level representation for planning graph, it's a great thing for planning graph, but it's no good for SAT because you unroll everything and convert it into encoding, constraints. Okay, and you can also make the search incremental across iterations. We pointed that out, memoization, etc. Okay, the negative thing is you need to adopt techniques already known in CSP SAT communities to your representation. The first idea you get is not likely to be a good idea. Okay, so that actually brings up the issue, has anybody taken some of the ideas that work in terms of SAT? For example, why didn't anybody write a solver which takes the planning graph data structure and starts building the subgraph without direction? Starts from the middle if needed and go forward and backward. Surprisingly, before planning was converted into SAT, a guy called Jussi Rintanen actually did exactly that, directly on the plan graph. Okay, but the painful thing, of course, and he was actually much faster than backward search. But then you can't keep up with SAT solvers. Right, and basically, in fact, his was the idea which actually pointed out, in 1994 or something, he has a paper basically showing non-directional search on planning graphs. That's exactly the same thing. So you look at what SAT is doing. He didn't look at what SAT is doing. Maybe he did in his mind, but essentially, you're trying to get rid of this, directional nature of search. You can do that. Now, well, he didn't win, okay? But in 2002, the planner that, won the competition, and by 2002, SAT plan was well established and it wasn't winning any competitions, partly because one of the problems is if you're looking for bounded length plans, SAT plan is the fastest game. But if you don't know what the bound is, then, you have to either start, small and keep increasing, and that turns out to be too slow. It turns out that, in fact, heuristic search planners that you've already understood before, which use the same, again, planning graph data structure, but as a reachability heuristic, they do faster. Okay, so, in fact, heuristic search planners were doing fine already by 2002, there was this planner called LPG, which I don't quite any longer remember what L and P and G stand for, but it essentially local search and planning graph data structure. Local plan graph, local search plan graph, yeah. It's a local search on planning graph data structure. Okay, in fact, one of the interesting things is when SAT solver started working originally on planning graph problems, the fastest solvers were local search solvers, WalkSAT and GSAT and so on. Okay, now those of you who know about local search versus systematic search know that there is one problem with local search solvers. They can't prove that a solution doesn't exist. They can prove that a solution exists, but they can't prove that a solution doesn't exist, right? Because there's no way they can exhaust a search space. So in fact, for local search solvers, this business of going the planning graph two levels, three levels, four levels, it doesn't really work. Because you cannot actually prove to yourself that there is no solution at fourth level if you're only doing local search. Thankfully, now the fastest SAS solvers are actually systematic solvers. Okay? And so you didn't have this problem at any rate. Okay? But what LPG does, in essence, is actually it's a pretty hairy paper. I think you guys should read it, but I'm not going to discuss it in the class. It's unfortunate that I'm not going to discuss it. But I'll tell you how to pigeonhole it. It essentially does direct search on the planning graph data structure. Okay, so it takes a planning graph, it picks a subgraph and sees if it's already a solution. If not, you do hill climbing. To do hill climbing, you need to change the current solution. Okay, so you basically look at, remember the eight queens problem? You come up with an assignment for all the eight queens, see if it's already a solution. If so, you get to go home. If not, you see what's wrong with this. And in the eight queens, it's only one type of problem. There are multiple pairs of queens who can't get along. They're killing each other. For a subgraph not to be a plan, there can be multiple types of problems. There may be actions whose preconditions are not satisfied. There may be actions which are mutually exclusive. There may be propositions which are mutually exclusive. There may be propositions which are not supported. So there are different kinds of problems. So for all these problems, you decide, which is the problem that I'm going to work on. More or less using the ideas of min conflict search. Remember what min conflict search would do? If you were to, change this queen's position, how many conflicts will go away? And pick the one that will change the most conflicts. Okay? So LPG actually does some similar kind of reasoning, but it actually also considers, for example, if there is a precondition that is not supported, then it tries to figure out how costly would it be to support that precondition. It won't necessarily say, if one planning graph, one potential solution requires a precondition, have $1 billion, and another one requires a precondition, have the hand empty. They both have one precondition missing, but they're not equal in terms of extending it to the solution. And the way you can figure this out is relaxed planning graph. One way, right? You can actually realize, basically the planning graph heuristics could tell you which precondition is harder than which one. And they use that also in their scoring metric. Okay, so they do a pretty sophisticated local search with these kinds of scoring metrics, and they beat the socks off of everybody. 2002, it was the winner. And then the most recent competition also, I think, most recent competition, there is a planner which essentially works off of LPG, which winds up being a winner. This plan called SG plan, which actually is even harder to explain because we know that it works, but we don't quite know why. So maybe we can read this and figure this out. But essentially, they work off of LPG. But the reason all this is interesting is that the jury is still out there. These are guys who are doing direct search, direct local search and planning graphs, and they're winning. One problem, of course, is you do have to write these algorithms yourself. Okay? And if anything changes, you just have to rewrite the algorithm again. And if you want to be lazy, you want to go compilation route. Okay? Or the heuristic search route. Okay. In terms of compilation, there is can exploit the latest advances in the various solvers, but then the negative problems are that compilation stage can be time consuming. It does lead to memory blow up. I pointed out that the original SAT solver died without solving any problem because it required too much space. Okay, makes it harder to exploit search from the previous iterations and makes it easier, but on the other hand, makes it easier to add other declarative knowledge. Once you convert it all into SAT, then you can throw in other SAT stuff. Okay, or once you connect all into IP, then you can throw in other IP constraints if experts give it to you in IP. Okay, that's the deal about LPG, and this is just that LPI LP thing. Then the last part of today's class is why go from planning graph to CSP SAT ILP? Why must you convert a specific way of doing planning into SAT or CSP or IP? Why not convert the problem into CSP SAT IP? So there is one way of doing planning was by basically doing this planning graph, and solving the planning graph and looking for a subgraph of the planning graph wound up being a combinatorial problem. So you could directly see, yeah, it can be converted into SAT and CSP. But really, why should you do that? Why can't you just say, if I ask you, unfortunately you can't see it well, so I'll put this light off for a minute. If I ask you, get me a k-length plan for solving this problem, why can't I write a bunch of constraints that must be satisfied on any k-length plan? And if it satisfies those constraints, it's a plan. I just have to write those constraints in my favorite substrate. Now, what are the constraints that make a plan a plan? The different ways of proving the correctness of a plan. So remember, I talked about three different ways of proving the correctness of the plan: progression way, regression way, and the plan, you know, plan space way, the causal link way. And every way you can think of for proving the correctness of a plan, all you need to do is essentially think about it this way. So if I'm looking for a k-length plan, then I know the following thing: this is the first, this is the second, this is the third, this is the kth level. Okay, and each of these, there is no magic. If you have total of A1 to AN possible ground actions in your domain, some of these will appear here, some of these will appear here, some of these will appear here. So in fact, the domain for first level is this, the domain for second level is this, domain for third level is this. You just have to pick the right subsets at each level. So the question is, if I pick something here, something here, something here, something here, all I need to check is it is a solution. And so I need to have a way of writing the constraints which, if they're satisfied, it's a solution. And the way you can write the constraints correspond to the different ways of proving the correctness of a solution. Okay? So this is now saying you don't need to think about planning graphs at all. You just can think of any which way of proving the correctness of your plan, and you get to write an encoding for that. Okay? And so it turns out you can write state space proofs, and it turns out we can point out that the graph plan way of proving the correct graph plans, planning graph being converted into, you know, SAT CSP IP winds up sort of being close to a regression proof, essentially. Okay? Whereas that basically means that you could also have like an encoding which does progression proof. So in the paper that you read, graph plan one is called backward encoding. Okay? And then there is the forward encoding, which is basically progression based proof structure. And then you can also have a causal encoding, which says that whatever you pick must satisfy the required constraint such that there is a causal proof. It's all a question of what constraints you're going to write. That's it. Okay? And for each of them, all of them are just as good an encoding as all others. Now the question, of course, is which is going to be faster. That's an interesting question. That's why it was important to understand when do you say an encoding is better than another encoding. And for those, you know, people who convert combinatorial problems, let's say, normally into IP and LP, I mean IP encodings, they do talk about this, you know, which encoding is supposedly better. And is there a way of saying that one is closer to the integer grid than the other one? But anyway, let's first understand the way the encodings are written here. So I'll do the state space proofs first. Okay, my way of doing it is going to be slightly different from the way the paper is, but once you understand that, understand this, understand that, it's all fall into place. Okay, so I have some subset of, you know, some conditions here, some actions here, some actions here, some actions here. I have to pick them. Okay, the connection to it looks like a planning graph, but ignore that right now. Basically, I have a bunch of actions at different levels, and there are propositions that can be true at different levels, and I just need to write some constraints as to which will be true at what level, such that the planning graph would, the plan would be correct. Okay, so propositions. These many things I must write even before I start. Propositions that are true in the initial state must be true in the initial state. propositions that must be true in the goal state must be true in the goal state. So if I'll do it SAT encodings for now because that's just easy enough. But you can convert all of these into any other encoding, you know, CSP or the IP encoding. So I will say these are constraints, by the way. It's a conjunctive constraint which becomes a set of, you know, clauses saying this variable is true, this variable is true, this variable is true. Okay. So in particular, you must realize that I'm going to have variables of the form a proposition dash level. For each proposition, I have k copies of that proposition, you know, corresponding to whether that proposition is true at level 1, level 2, level 3, etc., up to level k. And similarly for action. So I have a bunch of action variables, a bunch of proposition variables. Okay. And I know that these proposition variables must be true in the initial and the goals levels, the final levels. Okay. At least one of the actions at each level will occur is my next point. This is sort of a kind of a non-minimality thing. So there should not be any level where no action is being done. Because then what is the point of having k length encoding? It's really k minus 1 length encoding. Okay? At least one action must occur. And then if there is an action at a level, it would require its preconditions at the previous level, and it will make sure that its effects are true in the next level. Notice that I call these preconditions, effects, actions, but these are all variables, SAT propositions. So I'm just writing a bunch of clauses in terms of propositions. If this proposition is said to be true, then these propositions must be true, and these propositions must be true. That's what I'm saying. But, you know, in terms of the semantics from the planning side, these are preconditions and effects. This much you can understand. From here, I will do two different ways of extending it. So all these constraints plus, but the forward proof says essentially that a proposition P at level J remains true if no action occurring at the next level changes it, deletes it, basically. So this is the way you're going to connect the proposition's truth value at the level J to level J plus 1. Ultimately, that's the interesting thing, right? It's not just enough to say something is true at different levels, but if somebody makes you false, if you were true at this level and somebody made you false, then you would become false next level. Okay? So in fact, of course, so what I'm saying here is a proposition P at J remains true if no action, none of the actions that have been picked for the next level wind up deleting that proposition. That's all. And deleting could be negating. So if a proposition was negative to begin with, I just don't want to do positive. Okay. So if Pij is true and then for all actions that are picked up, none of those actions, to write this actually, all I need to do is basically I want to make sure that actions that get picked don't change the truth of PI. Okay? So what I wound up doing is, here is a tricky issue. How many actions am I going to pick up? I could pick up some subset of an action. Normally, what I need to do is, if I'm going to allow myself to pick a subset of all actions, then I would say Pij is true, and for a subset of actions that was picked, such that subset, none of them violates Pij, Pi will be also true at the J plus 1 level. Okay? If on the other hand, how many subsets are there, by the way, for n? 2 power n. Okay, that will be a huge number of constraints for each possible subset you will pick. So instead I might just say, look, I would ensure that I will only pick one action per level. If I were to do that, so I will say that at most one action per level, this one is saying at least one action, and now I am saying at most one action. If I were to say at most one action, then I get to write this just in terms of a single action, because at most one action means there are only singleton subsets. There are only n singleton subsets. Okay, this is the deeper reason why in the paper that you read, you notice that forward encodings are not parallel, whereas backward encodings are parallel. It can be made parallel. All you need to do is you need to write these constraints in terms of all subsets. And since that's assumed to be too painful, because that's going to increase the number of constraints exponentially, so you wind up doing assuming that only one action appears per level, and then this becomes easier to do. Yes, sir. Yeah, so that's basically what you do here in the backward encoding. So in the backward encoding, it says a proposition P changes values between J and J plus 1 only if an action appears, you know, happens, that makes it true. So this is basically classical frame, and this is explanatory frame axioms for those of you who remember your situation calculus stuff from Intro to AI. Okay, but I like to think of this as going forward and this as going backward. That basically makes my point that encodings are connected to lines of proof. Nobody else cares, but I do. You know, I think I want to know where the next idea comes from. And if I connect encodings to proofs of correctness, then any new way of proving the correctness of a plan, I have a new encoding ready to be grabbed. Okay. So then in this case, essentially, a proposition P changes values between J and J plus 1 only if an action occurs that makes it so. So if Pij was false at jth level and it becomes true at the next level, then it must be the case that one of the actions that change it have occurred. This is basically called successor state axiom, and this is called a classical frame axiom. But you could think of this as, if you're doing actions in the forward way versus you're thinking of proof in the reverse way. Okay? So if you have this constraint, then in essence, you have no constraint as to how many actions can occur per level. The only question is that no pair of actions that are appearing at the same level should be interfering, statically interfering. Not mutual exclusion. I'm not talking about mutual exclusion, just statically interfering. Now you might very well ask, what happened to the mutual exclusion constraints? We don't have them because we are not doing planning graph. Remember, we're directly starting, you know, setting up the encoding without actually doing any extra work. Okay, so in some sense, whatever planning graph adds, so this is the forward proof, which has its problems because you only consider one action per level, and so you have a much longer number of levels before you can find a solution. Okay. On the other hand, if you're finding sequentially optimal plans, this is as good as that. Because in sequentially optimal plans, only one action appears per level. Okay. This is backward proof. And the interesting thing is, if you were to write these constraints, you are writing something very close to what you did when you converted planning graph into SAT. The things that are missing are that you had also extra constraints. The best way to think about it is you have these plus some extra constraints that you could find out from planning graph only because you propagated planning graph from the level 1 to level k. Okay. So for example, if I knew these are the only conditions here, the planning graph would not put all these actions at this level. It will only put the actions whose preconditions are at least present, which means it cuts down some of the actions. Do you see what I'm saying? So then, if you want to do that, if you do that propagation, then apart from these constraints, you will start writing not A21, not A41, which is basically killing some of the values, you know, some of the things that can be set true there. Okay. Furthermore, if you also do mutual exclusion, then apart from actions that are statically mutually exclusive, you get to also write these inferred mutual exclusions. Now the interesting thing is, even if you don't do that, SAT plan would solve this problem. What it does then essentially is, when in SAT and CSP, if you do pre-processing, then the solution time will be slower. And how much pre-processing you do, such as the total time for pre-processing plus solution time was the lowest, is the question. Okay. And what Couch and Selman have found essentially, to their chagrin, was even though they wrote this nice paper about, you know, converting into backward proof, etc., in fact, the best idea that anybody has at that time is to actually convert, you know, to this, add all the constraints that the graph plan's propagation procedure unearths. So it turns out to be a good form of constraint propagation. Those of you who remember consistency enforcement in CSP, there's this question of level of consistency that you should enforce. Okay, if you enforce k-level consistency, you would normally spend n power k amount of time. Okay, to solve the CSP, in the worst case, you do 2 power n. D power n. Okay, now the question is, what level of consistency should you enforce such that the time you spent in consistency enforcement plus the time you spend in solving the solution seems to be minimized? And normally, it is arc consistency for most CSP problems. And if you consider what GraphPlan is doing in terms of CSP terms, what do you think it is? If you think of what mutual exclusion is doing in terms of CSP consistency enforcement, what level of consistency enforcement do you think it is trying to enforce? What? Say it loud. What? No. No. It's 3-level consistency. It's actually quite a nice level of consistency. Read this. Mutex propagation as CSP propagation. Okay. So the reasoning involved in GraphPlan's mutual exclusion propagation essentially is a directed form of 3-consistency. And what's beautiful is it's able to get 3-consistency so fast. And so it's not surprising that you can't kill it that easily. In fact, one idea that people have tried is, why don't you go like this, and if you don't really want GraphPlan to come and spoil your party at all, then try to do known kinds of constraint propagation on SAT. The problem is, the only way you can compete with GraphPlan's conversion to SAT encoding is to almost generate a specific type of constraint propagation procedure, which is a directional 3-consistency enforcement. You can do it, because there are many ways of doing consistency enforcement. None of the standard ones, the 2-consistency, arc consistency, don't work as well. Okay, so this basically tells you nobody has lost completely. Planning graph still has the advantage. It's this directional constraint propagation that it does without too much effort winds up making a big difference for the solution of SAT encoding. And where's the proof? The proof is in the pudding, in the sense that the first original SAT plan encodings were all using direct encodings without mentioning GraphPlan, because if you come up with an idea which doesn't cite somebody else, you get to be more famous, right? And so Couch and Selman obviously are famous guys, and they wanted to be even more, and so they actually did this SAT plan encoding. Unfortunately, the way to really get the performance they wanted was to go back to GraphPlan, convert it, planning graph, and convert it. And so they call it black box, and which basically runs the planning graph and converts it into SAT encoding. And the reason that's a good idea is because in the procedural form, you wind up doing this mutex propagation, which winds up being connected to a directional 3-consistency enforcement in the underlying SAT. Okay? Now, it turns out that you can also do, now that you can do the forward and backward, why can't I do plan space proofs? Why can't I do causal proofs? Yes, you can do causal proofs. Okay, and all you need to do is this. So you need to have, now you think in terms of steps. Each step is mapped onto one of these actions. Okay, so each step is mapped into exactly one action, that is these constraints. A step inherits the needs, adds, and deletes of the action it is mapped to. Okay, a step gets needs, adds, and deletes only through mapped actions. So a step doesn't just produce stuff. It only gets it through the action. Okay, that it's mapped to. And every need must be established by some step. That's all you want. And then, of course, in the beginning, you say there are some needs for the S infinity, which is the top level goal. Now, all that you need to do is how that establishment variable become true. And those are the constraints for that. If you want to establish, a condition Pj for Si by a step S1, notice what this is saying is, if Si requires condition Pj, then some some step, S1 or S2 or etc. SK must establish it. I don't really care which one. One of these steps must establish it. This is a beautiful thing. So I am somewhere here, I need this SK potentially can be mapped to this or this or this, but for some reason I decided it requires condition P, potentially because it got mapped to A3 which requires P. So now all I am saying is one of these guys better establish it for me. Now I don't have to say, all I need to say is these steps must establish. Now a step has to establish, that means it must get mapped onto an action which then gives the condition. That's what these conditions are, constraints are saying. The question of course is, how do you make the establishment happen? And that's just your causal link semantics. So if you must establish PJ at SI using S1, then I've decided in this proof, in this encoding, that that must mean that there's a link from S1, link from S1 to SJ supporting PJ. And then that link, now of course I'll define what a link means. A link from SI to SK supporting PJ requires that SI adds PJ. And remember, SI adds PJ means the step that it got mapped to adds it. That's the only way it would do it. And SI precedes the SK. That's the establishment precedence. Okay? That's all I need. Now, and then of course, link also implies preservation by every intervening step. So for every step that can come, that you know, any step SM that can delete PJ, it must be the case that either SM precedes SI or SK precedes SI. Now, what I wrote in this, for a small problem, if you have to write all the constraints, it would take 3 pages. And I'll make you do it, just so that you will, you know, you'll feel good about it. Okay, I mean, that's what you do when you convert something into assembly language, it blows up. Okay, and this is basically what you wind up doing. Yes, sir? Oh yeah, okay. Yes. What? Wait, this one? I don't get what you're saying, no. Yeah. Yeah, it should be, yeah, so there should be a constraint for initial state, S0, which basically only has adds that are true in the initial state. But I forgot to write. Okay. But then here is the other things that you, by the way, have to write. Because you wrote precedence and you're talking to logic, logic doesn't know a thing. You need to explain to logic everything. So precedence relation is transitive. It's symmetric. You have to write a set of constraints. Now, this is where you wish your SAT solver was lifted. In fact, you would have wished pretty much when I make you write the SAT encoding for any one of them, you really wish that these SAT solvers are lifted. Because if they're lifted, I'm already done. It's because they're ground, you have to consider every possible action, every possible precondition, and you have to write for each variable. Okay? Precedences are easy to write with just a couple of axioms in the lifted sense. But in the ground sense, you have to say for every step S1 and S2, if S1 is before S2, then S2 is not before S1. And if for every 3 steps, S1, S2, S3, if S1 is before S2 and S2 is before S3, then S1 is before S3. Fun stuff. You write all this, that would be causal proof. And it works. The question, of course, is does it work better than the other guys? Unfortunately, no. And in fact, it turns out that, I have lost a slide. Let me see if I can show this to you. I'll take like a couple more minutes, like 3 more minutes, and then I'll let you go because I don't want to restart this whole thing again next time. So it turns out, just to complete every possible circle, every possible cycle, you can bring the white knights back into this discussion. Just everybody feels good, you know, even white knights feel good. Okay, it turns out that instead of doing the causal link establishment the way I wrote, I can start exactly where I left off. Previously I wrote establishment requires a link, and then I defined what the link is in the previous encoding. I can write that establishment requires that, you know, somebody adds and somebody precedes, and then whenever there is a deleter, there is a white knight. Believe it or not, I, you know, made fun of white knight in the past. But if you use white knight in the causal encodings, it actually the encoding size becomes smaller. Okay, and so there's a paper by in AAAI 99 by Amol Mali and myself, which basically shows that bringing white knights back, if all you are interested in size, reducing the size of the causal encoding, okay, in fact, bringing the white knights back, and also furthermore, getting rid of the partial ordering. Because remember I yelled at the precedence. Precedence basically is painful. You have to write exponential number of constraints just to write the notion of precedence. Okay, so getting rid of the partial ordering and just letting the actions be in positions winds up having the smallest causal proof based encoding. But then you would say, when you do that, aren't you doing something very close to state space planning? You would be right. But then I'm not doing plan space planning in the previous slide anyway. The whole point of plan space planning is given the current partial plan, when I refine it, I get to put actions in between. When I have a fixed length encoding, I'm not using that advantage of partial order planning anyway. So why, when I lose the advantage, why pay for the disadvantage? Right? So you can actually get rid of the precedences and just use contiguity. And the only reason this is sort of interesting is after that, with all this, you can make causal encodings be sort of competitive as of 1999 with forward state space encodings for classical planning. These may well be very useful for some other kind of planning problems, once you understand it. Okay? So, this is the enlightenment, and stare at it, and see if you actually make any sense of it. Let me quickly go through it, and we'll go through it next class once more. So you can think in terms of bounded length planning as model finding. And if you do that, all you need to do is set constraints to encode lines of proof, forward, backward, as or partial, you know, causal proof or whichever proof. Notice that I'm going backward, that my explanation is going backward. That's why my Kierkegaard saying, you know, life only makes sense in the backward direction, but it must be lived forward. So constraints to encode lines of proof. Now once you have the constraints, you can solve the constraints. Now the question, of course, when you're solving the constraints, how do you solve them? You can use SAT, CSP, or ILP solvers. Okay? Now, having set the constraints, if you happen to do constraints in the backward proof way, then you get essentially something close to planning graph. And except planning graph also then does mutex propagation on it. So that means planning graph winds up doing a specific form of constraint enforcement, consistency enforcement on top of this encoding. Having done that, then since you have it as a planning graph, you can look for a valid subgraph of it using backward search. Level by level search. You can do local search the way LPG did it. Or you say, to heck with it, let me give it to somebody, SAT and CSP. Which is what we did yesterday and beginning of today. And then, of course, having got the planning graph, you can also just use planning graph for heuristics, which is what we were doing previous to last class. I'll stop there and let you ask me questions next class. Yes. What?
One more arrow this year.
Which is?
You can have a little dash arrow from that CSP or my
own program to heuristics. Yes, that's true too. That's a good point. Actually, in fact, even as I was writing this, I realized some arrows are missing. One thing is planning graph allows, what I already told you this loudly, which is planning graph allows constraint propagation in a procedural form. That is something that should go into this slide. This was a slide I drew in 2004. And then also, as I mentioned again in today's class, if you have an encoding, you can use relaxations of that encoding as the basis for heuristics. And certain types of relaxations, the only relaxation you thought about when you looked at planning graph is positive interactions, negative interactions. LP relaxation, for example, for MILP encodings, can actually take into account the objective function in coming up with a relaxed solution. So that's enlightenment. Okay. Think about this. We'll come back next class. We'll start doing partial satisfaction and cost-based planning, plus any other questions you have on this stuff. Thank you.